First of all, I really appreciate everyone doing this. It's kind of hard to predict where it's going to go, but the idea basically for conversations came from sort of that outgrowth of the HD Summit that Michelle and Michael are very involved with. And you guys have all experienced this. You see people at the conference, and usually the best part of the conference is the conversations you have there. So we thought maybe it'd be interesting if we could bring some really good minds together for topics that everyone has an interest in. So this conversation came out of the fact that the market has changed substantially over the last 3 years. It's gone from being really awful to now like it's going to be a lot better. And I've had topic discussed with each one of you individually, but never all of you collectively, so I'm looking forward to this. And the title of it, The Brands, Boutiques, and Purple Cows, really is a forward-thinking concept of the next 1 to 3 to 5 years, is where is this market going? And the thought was, you know, at one time brands were not that big of a deal, then they became a big thing, and then boutiques came in, and they became a big thing, and another market segment of their own, and then you have, you know, now you have Intercontinental doing boutiques. You know, it's gone from Schrager to Intercontinental, so that's quite a shift. And the concept of the purple cow is, and this came from Charles Warren, is that in a really highly competitive market where everyone is barraged with all kinds of information, you know, how do you distinguish yourself, whether it's your own business or it's your own real estate product or your magazine or whatever it is, how do you create something distinctive that will attract the type of revenues you're looking for and the type of growth potential and create, you know, sustainable competitive advantages. So that was the thought. So what I would like to do is just turn this over to Michael Adams. He is our moderator and does a great job of it, and let him kind of get this started.
Okay, thanks, John. If any of you checked in on the website, you noticed there was a wide range of questions. So and some of them I had to condense. So I hope that I'm being fair to the questioner in my reiteration of the question. So, but if I'm not, and if one of you happens to be the questioner, please speak up. I guess I'd like to just begin with one of John's concerns, and that was the idea of segmentations and the trend in mixed-use development. Seems to me there's, as John pointed out, more of that than ever with hotels and timeshares and hotels and condos. There's a recent piece in New York Magazine that the Plaza and the St. Regis in New York are now offering condo space for anyone who wishes to spend that kind of money. So, John, do you want to expand on that and talk about a little bit what's on your mind with that question?
Yeah, I'm interested in that for two reasons. One is that the surge of business we've had in the last 3 months have been in those kind of deals, and they tend to be large resort, 4 and 5 star investment vehicles that have combined hotel use, condo use, fractional or timeshare use, restaurant use, marina use, you know, convention center use. One is a vertical resort type deal that Simon and Dan are familiar with, and Vail. Another one is a horizontal 225-acre resort in Wisconsin, about an hour and a half from Chicago, that includes a water park. And one we're looking here in Atlanta that's a vertical development of about $100 million in scope. That's a high-end boutique on the lower levels, 223 rooms, and then 100 condos on top of that, along with the normal restaurant, health club, and parking. So what I'm seeing in the marketplace are these more mixing of uses, more sort of co-investing of professional investors and the private investor through the condo sales feature alongside the professional investor. And I'm just wondering if that is maybe the next purple cow. And I'd be really interested in what, you know, Simon and Dan are seeing out there, because they've got a whole different perspective on it than I do.
This is Simon. I guess I'll take the first crack at that from a couple of angles, since we just sold the Plaza here in New York. And I suppose maybe for those of you who aren't familiar with the transaction, I should just share some of the details, Michael, if that's of interest. We bought the Plaza in 1994 and have spent the last 10 years working it as best as we possibly could to make it a great hotel. And I think we did a reasonably good job. I think the Fairmont guys went in there and did a good job of bringing the service product to a level where it needed to be. I think that there was money spent on the physical product. But then, literally out of the blue, we got an offer, and we got offers all the time on the Plaza, as you might expect for an asset like that. But somewhat out of the blue, we got an offer from a residential group or a property group that had experience in historic residential conversions. And frankly, when they ran their slide rule over the numbers of the building and looked at its position and the views of the park and looked at the size of the building, because it is a huge mass of space, they formed a view that the value of the real estate as a residential conversion was significantly higher than it was as a hotel building. So they put an offer on the table that was substantially higher than any hotel valuer or any hotel investor could justify. So with some regret, we sold the hotel approximately a month ago.
This is Dan Abrams. We have not seen a high-end hotel project that did not have a residential or for sale or mixed-use component to it in probably a year and a half. And I think the explanation for that is actually kind of simple when you look at the mathematics. The cost of building, and in some cases owning, a full-service luxury-type hotel is rarely justified by the returns that you can get in terms of rate and revenue and that sort of thing. And taking any particular site, if you're talking about a development deal, and looking at the various uses, it's rare that it makes any sense to build out the entire entitlement in terms of FAR in hotel product. You wind up with much too big a hotel. And what the real estate community has figured out is that they can optimize the value and usage of a particular piece of property by having mixed-use facility that might have hotel, retail, residential components, whether it's condominiums or condo hotel, whatever it is, a for-sale component. And that's optimizing the value of the parcel, but at the same time, by creating a portion of the piece that is for sale and that can be liquidated in a relatively short order, the remaining cost basis that you have in the hotel, it tends to be manageable relative to the revenues that it can generate. And so we're finding that on these mixed-use types of facilities, that after you run the numbers out and you take out the revenues that are anticipated from the for-sale component, the remaining basis in the hotel is very, very reasonable relative to its cost. It's typically much less than its cost, and therefore the numbers for the hotel tend to work. And as I said, we haven't seen a project other than something like that in probably a year and a half. They're all coming in with a for-sale component.
This is Simon again. Just to echo, I think, what Dan said, we have a pretty significant investment in Four Seasons, the brand, so we stay fairly on top of, first of all, what Four Seasons is doing on the development side, but also what the other luxury brands are doing. And I would echo exactly what Dan said. I mean, when we look at the pipeline of our brands as well as the competition, very, very few, if any, of the major new development projects are just straight hotel. There's always a hotel and fractional, hotel and condo, hotel and office, hotel and something else. And the whole sort of mixed-use approach and being able to amortize or allocate the infrastructure across multiple uses, as well as, I think, achieve some synergies from either from a revenue standpoint or either from a cost standpoint. That's the name of the game on the new build side. But I guess to build on something that Dan referred to, you only have to look at the Wall Street Journal today, and the heading on the front page of one of the sections is investors buy real estate at record pace. And it goes on to say, wary of stocks, more individuals buy condos and rental property. And I think what's driving this an awful lot is that there is so much money sloshing around in the system. And I think that what's happening in the residential real estate market as a whole, and that's it, and the knock-on effect that it's having on our business is all about money supply and money flow. And there's just a ton of money that's going into the residential real estate market. And there are those in the hotel business or related to the hotel business who are taking advantage of that huge investor appetite looking for a hard asset investment.
Yeah, I think, this is John, I think you're right, Simon. We talked about this a little bit at ULI, and Lou Placentia went around the room and asked all the investors how much they were looking at investing in the market going forward, and every single one of them said as much as possible. But then when we got down to, well, how do you really see the returns there for all this capital, they really couldn't answer that very well. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but it was really money-driven more than market-driven, it seemed like.
I think that's right. I think that the group, the ULI group, was fairly uniformly uncomfortable with what they had to pay for properties, at the same time fairly aligned that they were just going to go and pay for them because they had to get money out the door. It was a very, very interesting bit of tension in the views.
Yeah. This, John, again, it's very odd that you have this capital appetite, and I think some of it is justified market-wise because there are trends of people, and this, I think this goes back to 9/11 and the technology boom combined, where people are uncomfortable with the stock market because you had 9/11, you had all this corporate scandal, then you had a recession, then you had the technology bust. So people are uncomfortable that they can't put their hands on some solid physical asset. So whether it's baby boomers or it's outside capital from the Mideast or the U.S., I think they're thinking the psychology is that if I invest in a hard asset, the value may drop at 10% or 20%. I'm not going to go to zero. And I have something, a hard physical asset, that maybe I can get some return out of. And I think that's driving a lot of this hotel condo development, where for right now, the psychology and the mindset is for people to put money into real estate, in one form or another.
This is Bob. John, The question I have is, how long do you foresee this mixed use trend continuing? Because it seems, and I'll answer it partially, it seems like what we have now is a growing supply side. And the only way that supply side works is if there's a growing demand side. And if we're talking about 4- and 5-star hotel properties, and the prices I've seen on some of these condo hotel parcels have been exorbitant, how many people are there out there creating the demand for this type of product?
That's the big question. I don't know where all this demand is coming from exactly.
Claude, if I may interfere, I would like to backtrack a little bit. I think that the reason why we saw so much of these hotel condos development is also for another two reasons. One is that it reduced the debt ratio at a time where debt was difficult to get. And the second one is that most of them were done in refurbishment, where the developer didn't want to end up with a 600 or 700 room hotel. And since they sold very well, the trend was established.
Claude, is the hotel condo, I've read somewhere that it's more prevalent in Europe than it is in the U.S. Is that correct?
In Spain, yes. Not in France and Northern Europe, not yet. In England, yes.
Are they urban hotels? Are they resort properties?
Both. We see in resorts the same phenomenon as you have in the U.S. with the timeshare. It's picking up again. But then it's called timeshare.
I asked the interval guy that's on our ULI committee if the condo trend has affected the timeshare business. He said it's had a big impact. And other than the distribution of having an exchange, you know, they're basically financing these things 100%. And it seems like if you had a choice, you would invest in something you might get a return on or you have some residual value in. There's a secondary market for it, where in timeshare there's really no secondary market. So if you thought about it from a personal investment point of view and you had a property that was a resort that you liked, or it's in Las Vegas or it's in Manhattan, you would think that there'd be more of a trend to the condo side of it than the timeshare because of the fact you have the residual value and the chance to pay for itself or make a return. So it'll be interesting to see how big a trend this really is. I think, personally, I think it's a substantial trend. I think there's a lot of things going on, both the fear of another terrorist attack, what it's going to do to the stock market, the fact the baby boomers want to have a physical asset that they can point to or they can go enjoy, rather than putting it into stocks where, you know, they don't know where it went, they can track it. But if you buy a condo in Fort Myers and you buy a condo in Las Vegas, you can go enjoy that, go see it. You know, it's a different use of equity. I think that's going to, to me, I think it's more than a temporary trend. I think it's going to last a while. And in the gateway cities, New York, Miami, you know, people from Miami come up from South America and buy a condo in New York is pretty much on fire real estate-wise. And it's, I think it's the only city in the country where you're having inventory compression in the hotel industry.
John, this is Simon. I think, you know, to talk about, you mentioned the baby boomers. I think to talk about this subject, and talk about the residential bubble or boom, whatever you want to call it, without talking about demographics is missing a huge impact. I mean, I think that if you look at the number of baby boomers who are approaching retirement, if you look at the advances in healthcare such that people are living longer and are active longer, and then borrowing something from Peter Yesowicz, if you look at the trend that has occurred over the past 5 or 10 years maybe, where people are now less collecting possessions but more collecting experiences, I mean, it all sort of ties together, and you could sit there and say, listen, find me a piece of dirt that is in somewhere close to a beach or a mountain or a golf course, and you know, I think people make mistakes if they make this assumption, but you know, find me a piece of dirt that's decent, build something on it to market to the baby boom retiring generation, and how can you miss? Again, I think that in the execution of something like that, I think some people will miss. But certainly if you look at the macro view, everything points to a continuing opportunity to sell second homes, fractionals, timeshares, whatever, to the baby boom generation as they sort of move into that those retirement years.
Yeah, you're right. It's also the younger people are also very attuned to traveling and all those kinds of experiences too. I mean, my kids are early 20s. They've lived in foreign countries. They've been everywhere. You know, their travel is second nature to them.
One of the questions, I guess, would be how this will affect the larger hotels in terms of new construction as opposed to renovation, and what do you see in that regard?
I see more new construction, and this I'd be interested in hearing what Dan and Simon are seeing, but there's so much capital, there aren't that many deals to recycle anymore that I can see. A lot of them have been done already. They're in the hands of the consolidators, Marriott or Starwood or a REIT. So I don't know where the turnover is going to come from on existing property unless the prices just get so high that people take advantage of that. So I would think it would drive more new construction, even though maybe it's not totally justified.
Well, this is Dan. It's more of a new construction type of product because you can configure the property the way you know the way you want. If you're going to do, let's say, a combination of a condominium and a hotel. And you're going to be selling luxury condominiums, you have to configure that property so the condominium owners have a separate entrance, a separate elevator bank, a somewhat different set of amenities and service. You can't really do it that easily with existing properties, that type mm-hmm. of setup. If you're going to do a condo hotel where people actually own the units that they're in, that's, you know, typically could be a conversion product from an existing property. So it's really going to depend on what you're trying to do with the property. I do believe that a lot of new construction will be spurred on by this type of format, and I do share the views of the other panelists that it's a very demographic driven. I agree with Simon there. I think the issue, it's interesting because we talk about this internally here all the time, but the depth of the demand. It does seem as though if you build a reasonable product with one of the, what I'll call, sort of scarce amenities, so it's waterfront or a mountain or a great golf course or something like that, that there's almost no end to the demand. That's what it appears to be. But we don't actually believe that. And we think that we don't know where it is, but there is a finite number of players who are going to be buying, you know, units at $1,000 a foot and more. There's a lot of talk of people who are, you know, now empty nesters and baby boomers who are selling their homes that are now worth, you know, multiple millions and buying, you know, expensive units in New York and other urban areas, and that all makes a lot of sense. But that only makes sense if they can sell their homes first. And you're not going to see people paying, you know, $2,000 a foot in New York if they can't sell their house out in Short Hills because interest rates have now gone up a lot. In other words, it does trickle down because you need people to move up into the homes that are being sold before the people can go and buy the new ones. So it is
related to interest rates. I do believe it is related to the strength of the economy, but it's clearly demographically driven, and it really is hard to say. I mean, on the one hand, where there are all these baby boomers and supposedly with a ton of cash, there's also a lot of stuff that you read in the paper about the savings rate and the fact that, you know, probably most Americans have not saved enough money for retirement. So I'm trying to figure out where all the people are coming from that are paying $1,000, $2,000 a foot, and whether that's going to go on forever. And it seems to me that it will not.
Where then does this leave the boutique hotel? Since that's one of the elements in John's title for this, what's the state of that in your view these days?
I'll throw my thoughts out quickly. I think boutique hotels, there are two aspects of boutique hotels. One is the extent to which they are a fad, just a unique new thing that someone wants to try once or twice. And that's some of the customers for boutique hotels are the followers of what's hot today. But I do believe that boutique hotels and other very targeted types of products have a role, and it's a role that was previously not filled, and it really has to do with the variety of tastes that the consuming public has and demonstrates. There will always be a group of people who like to stay in a small, stylish, more personalized, more residential kind of hotel, who didn't have that choice 10 years ago, who have that choice now. It's a segmenting of what I think was an existing market that was not served. And what we've seen, and I think we're seeing this in all phases of life, whether it's residential, real estate, hotels, the financial markets. If you look at something like securitization, where 15 years ago it was one type of fixed income investment, and now the same type of fixed income investment is sliced and diced into 20 different pieces to appeal to 20 different buyers, but it's the same underlying instrument, a mortgage, for example. Now you have the hotel business, which used to have, you know, four different types of hotels, but 20 different types of customers. Now you have 20 different types of hotels. From the big ones to the small ones, it's locational, it's service-oriented, it's extended stay versus, you know, true transient. This is all simply serving existing demands that was there but never addressed before.
Yeah, there's a term for this, and I think it's increased specialization. The term is called sneakerization. It comes from Nike. When they started, they had one shoe. Now they have over 200 different models, and it's a micro-market brand extension and specialization that goes on. To give you an example, you know, one of the deals we're looking at in Atlanta, that's a combination hotel condo complex, and this is, you know, vertically integrated, so condos on top, hotel on the bottom. It's a boutique brand. So they're taking the boutique brand, which is already a sub-market of the hotel industry, and then they're going to add the condo component to make it even more specialized. So I think that's the trend in every area of business, I think.
John, this is Simon. I think one of the things, if you were to try and look at the boutique business and sort of think about the design aspects of the boutique business and how it ties into this, my hero in the boutique business always was and always will be Bill Kempton, because I think what Bill Kempton did was he had a phrase where he said, he bought junk and he sold antiques. And essentially what he did is he went into emerging neighborhoods, he went into old buildings, and he took those closet-sized rooms and those unusual hallways and those strange bathrooms, and he actually, from a design standpoint, created something that he could sell at an antique price. And I think that, you know, there are lots of opportunities for Kempton and maybe some of the other guys to go into existing buildings and from a real estate perspective, design something that is appealing and unique and residential and very intimate that sells because of its uniqueness. And I worry a little bit about kind of the new build approach to boutique hotels. And obviously they all come in different shapes and sizes now, and I think kind of the cutting edge W approach will fill a certain niche. But I still think the best opportunity in the boutique business is to just follow what Bill Kempton said 20 years ago. You buy junk and you sell antiques.
As a PS to that, it's interesting that they are no longer using the term boutique hotels for Kempton properties, which I think is rather interesting.
They're calling them now.
I think it's lifestyle hotels, or but it's clearly the marketing choice was to was to say that it just has lost its impact.
And this is Dan. I have a question for Simon. When you say you think the better approach might be Kempton's approach, is that because you think that that's what the customer wants, they're more comfortable in an older, restylized building, or you think that that's the only cost-effective way to deliver that kind of product?
I think it's a cost-effective way. I think, you know, coming out of the conversation we just had on residential conversions and the housing bubble, I guess I would qualify it by saying that, you know, any situation where there is an old building that might have lent itself to a Kempton or something similar style conversion, you know, if that building has the potential to be reworked as a residential project, you know, forget about it. It's going to be a residential project. The hotel can't stack up. So I was going down that road because I think for certain smaller, older buildings, I think that from a real estate perspective, doing that kind of conversion makes more economic sense than a new build.
Kind of depends on the market you're in, too.
This is Bob. I wanted to add a couple of things. You know, we're talking a lot about supply here, and what I keep coming back to is I'm hearing everyone express views on trends, and Simon, I agree with you. I think this demographic trend on mixed-use property extends through the baby boomer, which would be, what, next 15 years probably, 10 to 15 years as people are buying up properties. But it's the demand, and what's causing the demand to make this happen. The first demand in this mixed use was a drive for luxury and service, personalization in the marketplace. People with high net worth wanted a place they could go to in multiple cities that would be taken care of for them. Rather than owning a house, they had a condo that had high-end 5- and 4-star hotel service levels to it. It's about experience. Michael brings up boutiques are no longer boutiques, they're lifestyle hotels. That says it right there. People are looking for that unique, individualized, customized experience and moving up in luxury levels. That was one of our prior conversations about luxury. But it's really that filling the demand as hotel operators or hotel owners, filling the demand of providing that experience, that lifestyle, and how that will proceed in the future.
I think that's kind of this, Johnny, and this is the purple cow aspect of it is, you know, what is that experience that's different than what people are getting now that will give you a competitive edge in the marketplace? Is it by combining the condo with the hotel so the condo owners get the hotel service? I think that's part of it. Combining the right hotel brand, whether it's Four Seasons, W, Ritz, you know, that gives you a micro market there that's different from somebody else. What's interesting in Wisconsin, I don't know how familiar you guys are with this, but there's a tremendous water park development trend underway in the Midwest that started up in the Wisconsin Dells, and they have these, you know, it's like Universal Studios or Disney, 70,000-80,000 square feet of, you know, basically it's warehouse space with water parks inside and hotel around it and condos, and people are buying condos for $350,000 to be close to the water park, not to mention the hotel rooms that are already there.
Hey, John, this is Michelle. What's fueling the water parks?
I think it's the experience thing. You've got a combination of weather in the Midwest where it's awful 6 months out of the year. You have a huge population around Wisconsin between Milwaukee and Chicago and Gary, Indiana, and the northern Illinois area. I don't know, 8 to 12 million people in there within a 2-3 hour drive of an area that's basically like Myrtle Beach. That's what started it in the Dells, was it was an entertainment destination, but it was, you know, it wasn't year-round. They added the water park, and all of a sudden it became a year-round amenity. And then they built another water park, and it gave another destination for people to go to. So they can go to restaurants there, they can go to miniature golf, they can go to Ripley's. You know, it's kind of like an Orlando-type thing on a small scale. And so now we're seeing water parks. We're doing a water park at O'Hare, of all places. The Radisson, Kennedy bought. We converted it to a Wyndham. It's like a $5 million conversion and a $28 million water park at O'Hare.
John, this is Michelle again. I have to tell you, I go to all those water parks with my kids, and I think you and I discussed this. I'm still waiting for somebody to design a Skybar concept so parents can watch their kids and be in a different room.
Oh, here we're going to try to do a slightly adult version of a water park, more of a Cirque du Soleil theme rather than a, you know, sands of the Kalahari. So, I mean, there's a whole other thing that is that's a regional play, but it has implications for what we're talking about, because what I'm seeing is if you're going to be competitive in the marketplace, you've got to offer, it may not be just a design thing in terms of creativity, it may be a creative real estate play where you've got to combine the right uses to not only create or satisfy the market you're looking for, but average down your basis at the same time, which has driven really all this mixed-use development, is reducing risk and reducing your basis.
John, this is Simon. Can I just direct a question to Michelle here? Because you posed the question, what's driving all this demand for these water parks?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would put it back to you. Since you go with your kids, why do you choose to go to them versus, you know...
another place?
Yeah.
Most of the time when I travel with my kids to water parks, it's usually for a hockey tournament. And there's obviously a lot of kids in sports programs. And for tournaments... they're always looking for a hotel, or the coaches and the managers are always looking for hotels that give kids an opportunity to do something other than skate.
Mm.
And if it's a winter sport, there's no beach, so the water parks are a huge appeal, it seems to me, in the Midwest. But I kind of see it more with, you know, the basketball teams or the hockey teams,
soccer teams.
These kids are there for a weekend. So parents are trying to find a property where they probably could have an experience, you know, an adult sort of an experience, and that's hence the Skybar concept, but so the kids can have a great time, too.
This is Dan. I actually am closing a construction deal probably this Friday on a hotel water park ground-up transaction, very large transaction, pretty incredible location, not in Wisconsin, but clearly will be taking business from the Dells and other Wisconsin locations. This is in Minnesota. And I've been studying the industry actually for a few years. It's a very, very interesting concept. It obviously doesn't work everywhere,
mm-hmm.
but it definitely works in cold weather climates, trying to get away from the extreme seasonality, summer and winter. Interesting facts about these things. They tend to run full or close to full in the summer months, believe it or not. Full and close to full on the weekends, fairly empty during the week, except for school holidays, when they pack them in. They're basically full. And what is interesting about them is that they provide tremendous price value to middle-income families. You get a hotel and amusement park experience without having to get on an airplane. Practically nobody flies to these things. They're all drive-to. And people, by the way, drive 3.5-4 hours to get to the Wisconsin Dells from Minneapolis, Chicago, other places, and have been doing it for years. But basically, you pay for the room, and you get the water park for free. Now, you pay more for the room than you would a regular hotel, but the water park hotels are designed to sleep in a room 4 to 6 people. There's generally a bed, and there typically will be a pull-out couch, and there often will be a kids' area with bunk beds. Basically, you pay for one room, 4 to 6 people, you get the water park for free, and they're being designed very, very intelligently to capture the guests and keep them spending. So you pay for the room, you get the water park for free, but there'll be a restaurant for the parents and maybe the family to have dinner in. There's a food court where the kids can eat food all day. There'll be a bar for the parents with a view of the water park so they can sit and drink and snack and watch their kids. Gift shops that do incredible amount of business. And when you get tired of being in the water, and the people who run these water parks know exactly how long, on average, kids below the age of 12 stay in the water versus kids from 12 to 16 stay in the water. So the question is, when the kids who are 12 to 16 who only stay in the water 2 to 3 hours a day, get out, what do? Well, you have a terrific game arcade where they pump quarters into machines for hours on end, and they're making money left and right with features that keep the guests in your facility. And in most cases, the guests don't leave.
As opposed to pursuing all the other alternatives in suburban Minnesota, right?
In the location in Minnesota where we are building, there are actually lots of other alternatives.
We're learning the business a little bit too, Dan. And it's interesting that they force everybody to get out of the water park, I don't know what it is, every hour and a half or 2 hours, as a safety check. But it's really a way to get everybody to go to the game room and buy food.
Yeah, go to the game room, go to the food court, go to the gift shop.
I figured it was to chlorine shock the pool.
Yeah, well, right. These things have been around a while, and, you know, I really definitely think it's a price-value kind of thing. The cost of a weekend for a family of four or six relative to flying to Orlando or, you know, almost anything else you could do, we have to get on a plane, there's a tremendous cost difference.
The strategy on O'Hare is kind of interesting because I don't know of another airport, water park, you know, anywhere. So this could be the first one, but it's the last hotel to fill there. They got it very cheap. They can be a water park alternative for people that don't want to drive all the way to the Dells. Maybe it's a shorter weekend, and there's a lot of people around the O'Hare area, obviously, within an hour radius. Where the ADR might be $80, you know, overall for the week, on the weekend the place is empty because no one wants to stay at O'Hare. So if they can capture business where it's $200 a room for a family of four, you know, the incremental bump in revenue is huge. And then if they can create a corporate outing type arrangement during the week, that's also added value. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all works out because it's a different application of a different concept.
Location
so.
The location that I'm working on, by the way, I can tell you, is right next door to the Mall of America. It's located right in between the Mall of America and the airport of Minneapolis.
That would make a lot of sense.
Great spot.
It's an awesome, awesome location. And about the numbers that we know, about 500,000 people from Minneapolis drive 3.5-4 hours to go to Wisconsin Dells a year. We only need to capture a quarter of those, and we're at 75% occupancy for the year.
This is Michelle again. Most of the water parks are mid-priced. Do you see a demand for luxury water parks?
Four Seasons Resort and Water Park?
I don't. I think that's why I said price values. I think that's the name of the game here, price value. Things we struggle with in this one in Minneapolis is that, you know, during the week, how do you book transient, regular transient guests? You know, that's one of the biggest questions we have in the underwriting is if you're a businessman and you're flying into a Bloomington or you have business at the mall, why would you stay at a water park hotel when you have other non-water park hotels you can stay at? You're not going to use the water park, so why go there?
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a demographic trend for business men or women taking their kids with them on trips?
Probably a small one. We think we'll actually pick up some business in this particular case where the family comes because the mom wants to shop. And she said, you know, we'll go to the water park hotel, which is next door. I'll go to the mall, and you, dad, and the kids will stay and play. So we think we're going to pick some of that business up. Shopping business for the non-shopping part of the family. It's an entertainment venue. It's a very price value oriented. And they're popping up in a fairly significant way in not just the Midwest, but in the Poconos, Niagara Falls. There's one in, I think there's one being built upstate New York. Quite a lot of places.
I think there's one in California now, too.
If there's one in California. I know there's quite a few of them in Europe, too, by the way.
Well, this dovetails a little bit into one of the questioner's concerns, which was the threat of another terrorist attack, and I say it connects in that will there be more call for domestic travel, both on the economy level and the luxury level, if there is another sizable attack and travel starts to diminish? Anyone want to take that?
Well, this is John. At our ULI group, we've talked about this several times, and basically no one can handicap economically what the impact would be. Everybody knows it's a risk. 80% of the people think it's going to happen every time we vote. It's the vast majority. Everybody's expecting it to happen. We actually rebounded pretty well from 9/11, so everyone's thinking that, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan or Simon, that the rebound would be quicker, have less of an impact, but it will obviously affect things. And the other thing we learned at ULI was right now the hotel economy has detached itself somewhat from the airline economy in that the passenger demand for airlines does not have as direct effect as it used to have on the hotel business. And that's probably because of the drive-to nature of a lot of the Wisconsin Dells type demand or, you know, wherever people are driving to, because I think drive-to locations obviously are a lot stronger now than they were probably before 9/11. But, you know, if you look at certain cities like New York, I mean, New York is on fire in terms of travel. So, you know, some things don't make sense to me. You hear about it's detached from airline travel, regional markets are really strong, but then you see New York that's really on fire. I mean, Simon and Dan, does that make sense to you, or is New York also a drive-to market besides a fly-to market?
I think New York is a drive-to market. I mean, one of the things, Dan, I don't know if you experienced this as well, but I think when you look at the strength of the euro or the weakness of the dollar, whichever way you want to look at it, as you walk up and down Fifth Avenue and around sort of the tourist areas of New York, there's an awful lot of Spanish and Italian and German and some of the Scandinavian languages. I think on the international front, New York is really, really inexpensive for a lot of these people, even though the market's on fire. I also think that from a shopping standpoint, you know, the States has always been a cheaper place to shop. And with the euro kind of hovering at, you know, 135, New York's on sale.
I think New York, if you look at the demand generators in New York relative to the hotel inventory, I think New York is probably the most under-hoteled city in the country. You also have to factor in the trend that we're losing rooms, not gaining rooms, because a lot of hotels are being converted to residential. But if you look at the number of square feet of office in the city relative to the number of hotel rooms, you look at the number of demand generators in terms of tourist attractions, entertainment venues, Times Square, airport traffic around the city, in other words, just people coming in and going out, it's very under-hoteled. So it doesn't surprise me, it never surprises me, when you can't get a room during the week in New York, which is now often the case again. And I think whatever shock there is to the system because of potential terrorist attack or whatever, New York will bounce back to the same position, which is during the week you can't get a room, and the weekends you can, but they're still running, you know, 60% on the weekends.
Although, Dan, I have to tell you, when we owned the Plaza, we were full. Saturday night was our strongest night for years and years and years. Now, when the road warriors really got out there and were driving midweek demand, but for hotels like the Waldorf and the Plaza and some of those sort of iconic hotels, the weekends have always been strong.
Was that drive-to or fly-in business? By the way, I'm not surprised at that at all, because a night at the Plaza, you know, was a treat. We drove in and did that, you know, from the New York suburbs.
I think it's a combination. I mean, one of the great things about New York is it is kind of the international destination for both Latin Americans, for Asians, to a large degree, and for the Europeans. And then you've got, you know, millions and millions of people who, you know, coming into New York. I mean, they're going to light the Rockefeller Center tree tonight, and this is a gridlock alert day. That means that you have just thousands of people coming into the city to see the Rockefeller Center tree lit. The Thanksgiving Day parade had 2.5 million people, was the estimate. And again, you had people trekking in from the suburbs, some of whom stayed overnight.
Yeah, you know, when you get numbers like that, which New York often does, you don't need a high percentage of those people to decide they're staying over and avoid the traffic and make it a little bit of a holiday to book most of your rooms.
Claude, is there a European perspective on this subject?
Well, New York has always been extremely fashionable for Europeans, and the exchange rate today is very much in favor of that. So I'm not surprised at what I hear.
But would another major terrorist attack here make a difference?
I don't think so. European tourists have always traveled. We haven't seen much lower numbers after 9/11 here. Even traveling to the U.S., people were going on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Americans would not travel, but Europeans would keep traveling.
Any other changes that you think? One of the questioners suggested an increase in more in elaborate resorts here that would fulfill the needs of the higher-end traveler. Anyone see anything like that?
I don't think any more than what we've already talked about. I don't know,
right.
I don't know if that's a unique market to itself of Europeans who want to travel to the U.S. and they need some particular product tailored to them.
I mean, this is Simon again. I must admit, with all the discussion of the water park, and then there was a comment, you know, do you see kind of a Four Seasons or a Ritz-Carlton upscale water park? I mean, clearly the answer is no. But I think if you look at the design of some of the upmarket, the five-star resorts, I think you'll see that the impact of the demographics is being felt within the luxury resorts, in that many of those luxury resorts, which, you know, 10, 15 years ago would have been mostly couples, are now affluent families, and you saw them doing two pools, you know, one sort of quiet adult pool, and then another pool where those kids that were on property would go. Now what you're seeing is, I think, an awful lot of those resorts, the upscale resorts, saying, well, you know what, we really do need to build more of a kind of water slide, kind of water feature attraction, because the affluent consumer that has, you know, two or three teenage kids, and if the kids are happy on vacation, then everybody's happy, they want the water slide. You know, that they see the ad for Atlantis and say, boy, I want to plummet 300 feet through a tank of sharks. The compromise might be that the, you know, Four Seasons Scottsdale puts in a larger pool with a couple of water features, but the parents will say, listen, I ain't going to Atlantis, but I will go to the Four Seasons in Scottsdale as long as they've got a pool that keeps the teenage contingent happy.
Simon, I think you're really, the analogy at the luxury end is the extra pool with segmenting the customer who's there so that they get along with each other, maybe by keeping them apart. But the features you'll see at the luxury properties are going to be, you know, signature golf courses, spas, not just a spa with, you know, two treatment rooms where you can, you know, order up a massage a day in advance. We're talking about significant space dedicated to spa and exercise, health, that sort of thing. You know, maybe that's the luxury equivalent to a water park. You're bringing the customer in, but the customer's going to a higher end kind of experience than, you know, kids running around getting water dumped on them.
Well, that does bring up another question, is concerns about amenities and luxury properties. And he or she suggested that maybe all of the impulse toward connectivity might lead to an impulse for lack of connectivity, where you go to a resort where there's no internet connection, where there's nothing but serenity.
Off the grid.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of what Adrian Zecca did?
Yeah, no television in the room.
Yeah, Claude was very involved with that.
And it works. People pay to not have a television in their home.
And does that include as well any other means of communication?
I think they have phones in most of the hotels, but not all of them.
That's kind of the whole eco-tourism component also.
See, the objective is to take out as many of these things as possible and then charge more for the room. You want serenity? Okay, well, pay another $50 and take out the TV and rip out the internet.
Right. Claude again. Isn't the answer flexibility? You can wire the room, and if the guest wants to plug a computer in every wall, you can do it. If he wants a TV, you just put the TV in the room, and if he doesn't want it, then fine.
Okay, why don't we wrap it up? First, I appreciate everybody's contributions and you know, kind of confirmed some of the things that I thought, but I got a little bit out of this I hadn't really realized before. I guess maybe it's the whole demographic part that you brought up, Simon. The specialization, I think it's helped me. I hope it's helped some other folks here.